Hey, it's the Bob and Elvis Show. Bob Seska here in Pennsylvania, and TV's Race Bannon, Elvis Dingledean there in Nebraska.
Hi.
It occurred to me last week as we were doing the show that you look exactly like Race Bannon from Johnny Quest.
Yeah. So you've said, and yes, I do. So thank you for that.
And that's certainly not an insult. Race Bannon was chiseled, masculine.
It's a damn handsome man.
So what is? I gotta find out. What is the air hump?
Oh God. Talking about life stories last week, and I was going back. It made me, I was talking about the construction worker business back when I sustained myself by dropping heavy objects on my head and falling off of ladders and sustaining mild burns. And it got me going back through my failed attempt at memoir. I was trying to write a book, little memoir, back when James Fry was in the hot seat for making all that stuff up about his life. I wanted to write a memoir that was actually true, and the title, it was going to be called Useless in a Crisis, a mostly true memoir with a asterisk, and then down at the bottom it said, "Suck it, James Fry." That was going to be my big memoir, and I got to reading it, and I remember that I was reading the story of the great air hump, and I just thought it was something I wanted to talk about because it's one of the great moments of my childhood. I was talking to my daughter this week about school, and we were kind of doing she graduated from second grade and she did really well, and she and I were talking about how I did in school, which wasn't good, and I was trying to lead her away from daddy's accomplishments in school. And one of my big triumphs was the air hump. I was a really bad kid in school. What kind of student you were.
Yeah, terrible.
I was just bored. I was bored out of my mind all the time. And we had to travel so much, we moved so much that the only way I could make friends was to be, kind of a jackass, kind of the class clown, right out of the gate.
Fancy that.
And I had this success, this just endless lineup of douchebag teachers that just didn't appreciate, my sense of humor, I guess.
I can't imagine.
Because what I am is very appropriate. You may have noticed, my humor is extremely mild, very appropriate. Mm-hmm. Not at all shocking or insulting in any way. And I had this teacher whose name I won't mention because that would be indiscreet, but it was Doris Kenny. Her name is Doris Kenney, Doris Kenny. She
385 Walnut Street.
Yeah, I would Google her, but surely she's burning in the ninth level of hell right now,
right.
With many, many minions poking her with the hot implements.
So she's dead.
We can only hope. I didn't kill her, but that's not to say that somewhere there is a student harboring deep, deep murderous thoughts for this woman. Doris Kenney, Kenney, asked for her by name. This is when we lived in Germany. So she was, we lived on an American base and it was an American school, but I hated her. She hated me. I hated it. She could just the way she wrote on the board annoyed me.
You lived in Germany, but you didn't have the pleasure of having a German Frau as your
right.
As your grade school
teacher. All the benefits
teacher.
Of living in a foreign country were, we're not there. It was an American base, American school.
Right.
No Frau. We learned how to count. I think the total exposure to German was, ein, zwei, drei, and maybe a field trip to, the place where Hitler exploded.
Schnell, you're learning.
Yeah.
Schnell.
We got to travel quite a bit, but there was no real, I was seven. So what are you going to do? So it was in this class and it was really just, I don't know if you're of my generation. You remember the listening station as a means of teaching kids, where there's a massive tape deck in the center of the,
yeah,
like a 1950s, almost a reel-to-reel unit,
Uh-huh.
And everybody, this is so teachers don't have to actually teach. They don't have to get up and say anything. They give you this tape deck, and there's like eight kids around a table, and you're all wired into this thing with these massive, like World War II bomber pilot headphones. you know, these giant cans on your head,
right?
With this, with the huge metal strap, with the you know, with the foam wrapped around it, and that would sink, you know, that would rock back and land on your spine,
right?
And like just start crushing you. You'd get scoliosis from wearing these things.
Yeah,
and it had the, you know, each headset had the curly, the very tightly curled, you know, cord, right?
Yeah.
So from above, it just looks like this giant octopus consuming these eight, you know, each tape with eight kids listening to, and the tape would be, in 1922, you know, you're just like, oh, Christ, I'm dying, just bored out of your mind. So we were, the great air hump happened on a day when it was like our fifth straight hour of the listening station. And I was just out of my mind with boredom. And Miss Kenny, K-E-N-N-E-Y, was up at the chalkboard writing some goddamn thing. I don't know. And I thought it would be funny to show her some mild body approbation, to basically give her, I probably started by giving her the finger, you know, or maybe the, you know, the arm, you raise the arm and you put your hand in your elbow, that thing, and that probably got a few little titters. So I'm like, I'm rapidly escalating my body gesture.
So here's young Elvis with the giant the giant hat of hair, and I'm imagining lederhosen.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay.
Short pants and lederhosen.
Right, with the socks pulled all the way up. Like, you know, basically an escaped cast member from The Sound of Music, just with a giant wick of hair.
And no musical talent.
No musical
talent.
That's
right. And these massive World War II headphones on my skull. But because my hair is so dense, I've got the headband thing, the thing that holds them together, I've got that down around my neck. Okay? So you've got to picture this. The tables, our tables were like, they were like lab tables. They were really high tables, and we had stools. We didn't have chairs.
Yeah.
We had stools. So we're at these very, very high tables, and we have stools, kind of like old bar stools. And so Miss Kenny, K-E-N-N-E-Y, is up at the board, and she's writing something. And I'm giving her various gestures of body mockery, you know, the finger and this and that. And then this is around the time, the age where you're becoming aware that there are such things as sexual innuendo.
Yeah.
And it's really funny. Wee-wees and pee-pees, it's all very hysterical, right? So I want to give her a little bit of a very, very disapproving gesture. I want to give her what I call the air hump, which is basically you have to be standing and you put your arms out and you thrust your hip area back and forth as if to suggest that from a very far distance at my listening station with the World War II earphones around my neck, that I'm able to have Congress with this woman through the air to her back. So really what I'm doing is feigning, you know, is miming the act of some sexual Congress that at my age I could not have possibly imagined, really. But I just knew that humping in the air, pointed at Miss Kenny, K-E-N-N-E-Y, was hilarious.
So this is, going for the smart. You know, the smart comedy.
It's the smart. It's the cutting edge.
Right.
It's the very, very Swiftian, nature of my humor. Yes. Extremely cutting edge comedy here. So I get up on my stool in my little short pants. You know, remember back then I was extremely chubby. I was a very round child. I found a picture of myself the other day where I was at the beach and I was very skinny and out in public with my shirt off. So I knew it was a very old picture. And I was tan and thin. I was like the all-American kid. And then I got pneumonia and I almost died. And I was like down 20 pounds. And my mom decided the best thing to do was to medevac me, you know, airlift me to the States and directly into a Burger King. So I spent an entire summer eating Burger King to revitalize myself. And from that point on, I was a very fat person. I'm pudgy. I'm round. I've got the big hair. I've got the earphones on with
lederhosen.
The thing around my neck.
Yeah.
Lederhosen. And I'm standing now while Miss Kenny is writing on the board with her back to the class. I'm standing on my stool and I'm progressively and I'm humping the air towards her. So I'm making this gesture towards her back as if I were humping her.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I don't know why that implies some disrespect. On, you know, in retrospect, it really sounds like, you know, I kind of had a thing for her, and maybe I did. You know, maybe I really did want to, you know, get under that plaid skirt, that ankle length Quaker, you know, with her clunky shoes and her very thick, you know, knee high stockings. Maybe that was really something I was going for when I was 8 or however old I was. But the whole class, the class starts to titter, and I'm realizing as I'm escalating the thrust ratio and the power, the hip to air, you know, coefficient, as these things start to escalate, I realize that the comedy involved in this is going to that the reaction is going to far outstrip my ability to disengage. In other words, the sound from the laughter is going to reach Miss Kinney, K-E-N-N-E-Y. She's going to get to her ears, and she's going to whip around on me before I'm able to disengage. And this is all occurring in my retarded head as I'm, you know, viciously pumping the air at her in this air hump maneuver. And sure enough, the laughter grows from, you know, mild titters to just this uproar. And of course, Miss Kinney thinks, oh, well, there must be something hilarious. You know, a clown must have entered the room, or a, you know, something. Chevy Chase has arrived, everyone.
Or like, in this case, an Oompa Loompa in Lederhosen with giant headphones.
I'm not purple. Right? I have some self-respect. Oompa Loompa, that's nice. So yes, here's this really fat kid up on a stool with these earphones around his neck and then madly humping the air, and Miss Kinney whips around like a cat whose tail's just been pulled. You know, she whips around and goes, and she, and so as she's whipping around, it occurs to me, I've got to disengage. I've got to somehow go from vicious air hump, vicious thrusting of the hips towards her, to a seated position and look nonchalant like James Bond, just done, right? I mean, there's no way I can do that. I'm standing on the stool.
Right.
So I think I'm just gonna, you know, rappel down this invisible rope and land on my butt on the stool and I'll be fine. And none of that goes right. I sort of trip myself up. I'm tangled in my earphone cord. And I should say this, the earphones, the headphones are not, it doesn't have the big giant plug that plugs in. It's hardwired into the deck. So each headphone cord is physically wired into this box in the center of the table. So I try to slip down to the stool. I trip. I slip myself up. I go flying off my stool, ass backwards. I mean, just catapulting like the Lipton tea guy, going, you know, spread eagle backwards. And as I go, the headphone cord is caught around my neck because the cans are, you know, strapped to my neck. And I pull the whole tape recorder with me as I'm falling, and every other student hardwired to it is pulled up onto the table.
Oh my God.
Like they're belly surfing, like they're waterboarding on their stomachs.
Right.
I go flying off, land on my back, and literally seven other kids are yanked up onto the table by their necks because of my shenanigans. So and then, you know, Miss Kinney comes over and stares down at me, and I can barely catch my breath because I've landed so hard on my fatness. I've bruised my fatness, and there's all these kids on
with,
the
like,
table
broken with, collarbones all around,
yeah,
and yeah.
Yeah, with these kids for weeks had these bright red welts across their neck where their headphone cords had lashed them like Indiana Jones's bullwhip. So yeah, that was it. So my advice to my daughter, to Peanut, is, you know, only perform the air hump when you're sure of your exit strategy. You know, you've got to have an exit strategy. So
but that implies the go ahead. You've given your daughter the go ahead for the air hump.
If she has a teacher like Miss Kinney, sure, K-E-N-N-E-Y, Doris Kinney, yes, absolutely the go-ahead for an air hump. Just have an exit strategy in all things: oil spills, Iraq wars, air humps. Have an exit strategy.
And it's not easy. I mean, you're literally going. I mean, you did what you had to do. You can't go from 60 to 0 right. in the snap of a finger, or in this case, right. the turning of the Doris Kenny. I mean,
yes, the cat-like,
right. The reflexes. The, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, really, it was like a film splice where she was standing facing the board in one frame and they cut out the 700 frames between
right.
that and her turning. And it was just, oh my God, she's facing me now.
Right.
And I just had no way of reseating myself
yeah.
without plummeting and falling on and bruising my fat.
Maybe she was like the Terminator yeah. where she, you know, she's facing one direction, but she
yes.
can just morph and then the back of her becomes the front of her.
Right. The T-1000, not
yeah, the
T-1000 model.
Right.
Yes. Correct. That yes. And I would not doubt that she has very Terminator like powers.
So.
Doris Kenny.
Right.
So
the air hump
story.
So
yeah,
story.
That's the air hump. And someday I'll tell you about how, I faked a seizure to get out of a science test.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
And what you were saying about, I mean, what you said about pneumonia was true, right?
Well, yeah, that was true. But, I faked a seizure and it turned out that I had diabetes. So that was a fun day.
You still have diabetes?
I don't know. That's I don't know. I don't
Good
know.
Good answer.
And here's why I don't know. In Tampa, when we lived in Tampa, Florida, God help us, the Army medical facility there said I absolutely did. That I had the type, you know, the kind that you just do with diet and whatever, you don't need insulin, the type 8 or whatever it is.
Yeah.
We did the glucose tolerance test, where you have to not eat anything and then drink this vat of sugar water and then get tested. And so we did that a couple times. And in Tampa, they absolutely said, yes, you've got this mild diet manageable diabetes. And I was like, oh, all right, whatever. Then we moved to Virginia and we get to Burke. And I go and do the glucose tolerance there, and they said, no, you're fine. There's nothing wrong with you. So I don't know. 50%, you know, there's a 50% chance that, I mean, one of those guys was wrong. One of those labs was wrong, either the Tampa lab or – because I sure didn't beat it with diet because I was sneaking 2-pound bags of Twizzlers like there's no tomorrow.
Jesus.
You know, a day after they told me you got to cut back and this and that and do the diet, I'm like, yeah, sure, I'll do that. Then I go to People's Drug and buy a monster bag of Twizzlers and a Coca-Cola.
People's Drug, bing, bing.
Ding, ding.
I remember People's Drug, yeah.
Yes. So, yeah. No, I absolutely did not manage my diabetes correctly. You know, as far as anyone that was watching me was concerned, I was. And then, you know, midnight in my closet eating, you know, Twizzler after Twizzler.
Yeah.
So I didn't really take it very seriously because as far as I was concerned, the whole point of going to the doctor that day was because I had faked a seizure. So there couldn't possibly be anything wrong with me because I'd faked it.
You faked it.
I didn't want to take a test. So between one class and another, I lay down, started twitching violently and pretended to have a seizure because I figured
oh
that would
God.
At least get me enough nurse time to get me out of this test that I wasn't prepared for.
I mean, some people, you know, have intestinal distress. They, you know,
yes.
I'm dehydrated. Maybe that's a common excuse amongst kids. You faked a seizure. I mean, you went with
a full on grand mall seizure.
The dramatics. The unbelievable.
At Greco yeah. Junior High, the same school where that really hot blonde teacher got caught banging a kid.
Yeah.
That blonde Floridian woman that was driving around with a car full of her students and,
right.
and banging. She taught there. I can assure you that none of that was happening when I was there. I wouldn't be faking seizures if teachers were giving out, you know, the booty at the time that I was there. But there was none of that. There was just really hard science tests that I didn't want to take. So I faked a seizure. I very clearly remember a guy, a crowd gathering as crowds are wont to do when a fat kid is writhing on the ground
with Lederhosen,
you know, pretending to have a problem in his brain. I was a crowd gathered and one kid said, "Who hit the boy? I demand to know who hit the boy."
See, that could have been your excuse for the air hump. I was just, this was a seizure, and that's just how it plays out. I just it's vertical, and I go like this, and yeah.
Right. It's right. I've got Tourette's.
Right.
It's you know, it makes me curse and it makes me gesticulate naughtily. But the whole day prior to the fake seizure, I had been eating Jolly Ranchers like they were, you know, baby carrots. I'd been throwing down Jolly Ranchers because my whole thing in my Florida experience, before there was such a thing as Sam's Club and Costco, the only way you could get bulk items like that was to belong to, like, you know, so to be in some business where you needed warehouse access.
Yeah.
And my best friend at school at the time, his dad was in the, I don't know, he was mobbed up. He was part of the, his dad got blown up by the Florida mob. No kidding. The Florida mob blew his father up.
Oh my God. Just,
it blew him up in a car.
Like Casino.
And killed him. Oh yes. But before he was blowed up, he would get us access to this warehouse that would sell bulk gum and candy bars and Jolly Ranchers. So we'd buy them for pennies on the candy and sell them at school for 25 cents. And we made, I mean, thousands of dollars. We were little mini Donald Trumps, and we were getting busted every day. I mean, every day I would get my stuff confiscated, and I'd have to go to the principal. And this was a whipping school. I don't know if you ever went to a whipping school. I don't think any schools in Virginia were really whipping.
No. I went to Catholic school, but they didn't whip us there.
Oh, well, Jesus. I would think that it was mandatory to get whipped at Catholic school.
Yeah, I went to Holy Spirit. I mean, it's, Holy Spirit right there across from Kings Park.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I know that is. So no, the Tampa was a whipping school. They love them some whipping. And what the what they would do, they'd give you a choice. They'd say three licks, you know, three whammos with the paddle. And it was a paddle. I mean, it was a sorority boy. Thank you, sir. May I have another paddle? It had air holes in it for maximum, you know, velocity and aerodynamics. So they'd say three, and every kid ever would say the whipping, the paddling, because the other three was 3 days of suspension, and that went on your record. The spanking didn't. The spanking was just, you know, you took your licks and you walked home. So yeah, I would regularly take the paddling. And that day I had been eating Jolly Ranchers. So when I got to the doctor, because I'd had the seizure, my parents came and got me and then rushed me to the hospital because I had a seizure. The nurse, when they were triaging me, said, well, his breath had sort of a fruity, there was sort of a sucrose, which apparently is some diagnosis of diabetes. So joke's on me.
Right.
And I didn't want to say, well, no, ma'am, actually that's, you know, 12 pounds of sour apple Jolly Ranchers.
Right. I mean, little did they know that you're Augustus Gloop, right?
Yeah. Again, with the Willy Wonka. What is your deal? Did you just watch Willy Wonka?
No. When was the last time I made a Willy Wonka? Oh, yeah, yeah. Oompa Loompa. Yeah.
Oompa Loompa.
Yeah, right, right. So, I mean, you're... Well, I mean,
let's go through the entire...
Look,
okay, so
If the shoe fits...
I went to see Get Him to the Greek the other day, and they gave us, they're handing out this new Wonka candy.
Right.
When you buy the ticket, and they're like, here's your sample Wonka candy.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and I was trying to, you know, as I will, I'm just kind and polite and lovely to everyone. I said, will this turn me into a giant blueberry? And I got the densest stare I've ever gotten. The what the fuck are you talking about stare of a lifetime. Obviously no fan of the Willy Wonka, this troglodyte that sold me the ticket. So anyway.
Please move along, you know, Mr. Bannon.
Yes, sorry. They sent me to the doctor, and they smelled, you know, fruity, a fruity smell in my breath, which apparently in the DVRM means that you are, you know, diabetic. So they put me on that. That's why they put me on that schedule of tests.
Okay.
And it came back positive. And for all of that, I missed going to see Chicago in concert, because that night I was supposed to go to Chicago. And I had to call my friend and say, I can't go because I have diabetes.
See, the more we peel back this... onion, that is.
The onion that is Elvis.
Elvis,
yes.
Dingledane. We discover all these connections. So we've gone from Germany, air hump, seizures, Jolly Ranchers, and now the band Chicago.
Yes, was going to see Chicago, but here's the, and there's even a story to that. My parents didn't know I was going to see Chicago, or certainly not with the guy I was going to see it with, because they hated him. So I was going to have to, at the last minute, figure out a way that I was going to be out of the house for about 5 hours.
So Chicago was verboten in your house, right?
No. It was the guy I was going to
see. The devil's music, friend. Right?
he was foreboding. No, yeah. No, my parents aren't Quakers, for Christ's sake. My dad was in a rock band in the 50s. Jesus Christ. It wasn't the Chicago. And this is how lame I was. I mean, I wasn't sneaking out to see Ozzy or, you know, Stryker. That was really cool. You know, no, I was going to see Chicago. Peter Cetera, for Christ's sake.
Right.
No, it wasn't the band. It was the company I would be keeping. They hated this kid because he was awful. So I was going to have to figure out a way. I can't remember if I told them I was going, but I just didn't tell them who with, and I was going to just run out the door and go, okay, see you. I'll be home. Bye. But I didn't get to go because I had diabetes. And now I either do or I don't. So I don't
you
know.
Don't. Should, you don't have diabetes.
Should my feet be black and blue? Is that normal? So
oh,
yeah,
my
childhood is a vast tapestry of terrible. You know, I'm an only child, so I had quite the imagination.
There you go. That's that's the heart of it all, isn't it?
Yeah.
The only child syndrome, right? That's why you're pretending to hump your teachers and having seizures.
Yeah.
And
having fake seizures.
Just acting out, you know. If you had a sister, you know, you would have
everything would be fine.
You'd have directed all your rage, your obvious rage at the world, directed at her.
Pull her ponytails, right. You know, put sand in her diaper, whatever it took. But yeah, I didn't. It was just me. My parents decided, boy, that we really didn't want this in the first place, and let's not do that again. So
let's get into this Glenn Beck trailer for his book. Now you can't.
Speaking of sand in the diaper,
that's right. I mean, talk about peeling back the onion. I mean, this thing. If you haven't seen it, it's on the blog. I've posted it on the blog. You can go look at it. In fact, it's everywhere. It's on YouTube and so forth. This is a trailer for Glenn Beck's new thriller. It's not a political book. It's a thriller.
It's a novel.
Right. It's a novel. It's called The Overton Window. And this here now is the actual trailer.
Yes. We're not making this up.
For The Overton Window.
As it will be in the future, it was at the birth of man. There are only four things certain since social progress began.
So we got a poem here. Now, there are like golden words appearing in front of sort of a cloudy sky background. And the voice, I'm guessing, is his deep voice Morning Zoo sidekick, Pat Gray.
It really sounds like it, yeah. With a healthy dose of phlegm.
With a tracheotomy.
Yes.
Let's continue.
The dog returned to his vomit.
All right, wait. What is that? Wait, now what? What is this?
We have to go back. Come on, man.
It was at the birth of man.
There are only four things certain since social progress began. That the dog returns to his vomit and the sow returns to her mire.
The dog returns to his vomit and the sow returns to her mire.
And the burnt fool's bandaged finger goes wobbling back to the fire. And then after this is accomplished, and the brave new world begins, when all men are paid for existing, and no man must pay for his sins, as surely as water will wet us, as surely as fire will burn, the gods of the copybook headings, with terror and slaughter return. The Overton Window, a thriller from number one bestselling author, Glenn Beck, coming June 15.
And there you go. So now, I, being a completely uneducated doof, I had no idea that this was actually ripped from a poem.
That's correct. The wonderful Kipling poem. I'm quite the Kipling fan, so I recognized it immediately because I'm smart and Glenn Beck is dumb. It's the gods of the copybook headings. It's a Rudyard Kipling poem.
Yeah,
and I believe it's the last couple of stanzas. The whole poem is about social change and about the consistency of reality is the best way to put it. It's about how really nothing changes. And there are these gods of the copybook headings and they basically sit back and watch and nod and say, yeah, well, suck it.
Right.
But the dog vomiting thing, that Kipling actually stole that from Proverbs. As a dog returns to its vomit, so a fool repeats his folly. That's Proverbs 26:11. So it's biblical, it's Kipling-esque, and it's obviously very scary because of the way the guy was reading it.
Yeah. And the guy being Dr. Claw from Inspector Gadget.
Right? Dr. Claw.
Yeah, here, I mean, here's Dr. Claw from Inspector Gadget.
One today, Gadget. I'll be back.
Dr. Claw.
Go Gadget douchebag.
One today, Gadget.
All right, that was Dr. Claw. Here's the voice guy.
It was at the birth of man.
That is the same guy.
Things certain since social progress began.
Right.
Yeah, you always wonder what happened to Dr. Claw.
Right.
Gadget, but be back. Stay, Gadget, but I'll be back.
Right.
The dog returns to his land, and the sow returns to her mind, and the burnt fool's bandaged finger goes wobbling back to the fire.
All right.
Ugh. But what I don't get, I mean, that obviously the Overton Window, which is the sequel to the best-selling The Macintosh Portcullis, by the way, obviously has something to do, like, obviously the bad guy in the Overton Window is a big Kipling fan, and that maybe the bad guy organization is called the Gods of the Copybook. Obviously, there's going to be something in this book that references that poem, but when you just do it in a vacuum like that, when you just have a scary... When you have Dr. Claw reading those lines and you've got it in a book trailer, confusing as all fuck. Who is going to know that that's the dog returns to his vomit? That's the worst marketing campaign I've ever seen in my life.
Right.
Unbelievable.
And I'm wondering what the Overton Window has to do with it.
It's the whole book is the bad guy's looking through the Overton window, and then the good guy, who I guess is Overton, has to jump in and out of the window. Like every other chapter, the bad guy's, oh my god, and then the bad guy showed up at the window, and I closed the window on his fingers. Aye! And then the dog returned to his vomit, and then Overton jumped through the window, and then he ran around the house and came through the other window.
Right.
It's just all about windows, Bob. Come on.
Oh my god.
The Overton window.
Right, and you know, the Overton window is a political theory, right? About the range of discourse.
Yes, yes,
yes. And
I just don't want to give Beckett that kind of credit.
Well, I mean, it's so bad. I mean, it's so cliche. I mean, it's just like Overton window. Oh, that's a great. You know, it's like he's going through the political dictionary.
That's exactly what he's doing.
It's like, you know, like when you're in a garage band in high school, you're like going through the thesaurus. Oh my God, look of that. Look, steel trajectory. What we'll call our. Ooh. I don't know, steel trajectory.
Right.
You can use
guitar
that.
Guitar string.
And the cover evidently is like a bastardized Statue of Liberty. It looks like a man.
Yeah, like, it's very weird. He's very muscular and like he's wearing like a half-assed toga, and I don't know.
I'm convinced that this is the evidence we've been looking at. He's just effing with everybody. He's just this is all. I mean, it's like Spinal Tap.
Right.
I mean, this is exactly what it is. In fact, here are lyrics to an actual Spinal Tap song called The Majesty of Rock. And it reminds me exactly of these poetic lines here in the trailer. It's the majesty of rock, the pageantry of roll, the crowing of the cock, the running of the foal, the shepherd with his flock, the miner with his coal. We're in this together and ever. You know.
Nice.
The darning of the sock, the scoring of the goal, the farmer takes a wife, the barber takes a pole. I mean, that's an actual Spinal Tap lyric.
That's awesome.
That's
Beck is just, honestly, I believe he's just, you know, what every day he wakes up and says, what is the boundary? Where is the threshold of the level of shit I can shovel on these people?
Right.
And they come back and say, thank you, sir. May I have another big, giant helping of shit. Like I was saying before the show started, I got an email from my local wingnut asking if I had this book in my library because I have quite the extensive library. I mean, I think my own personal book collection rivals my small peanut town's, you know, my hick town's actual public library. And she's wondering if I had this book, and I had to, you know, no, because it was published in 1944, and I don't typically keep these, you know, vague economic screeds around the house from the 40s. So I knew, once again, Beck is talking about obscure books that he's read the jacket flap and gone, oh, this is, but it's one of those books. It was F.A. Hayek's The Road to Serfdom. And when she wrote me the email, she spelled it S-U-R-F.
Oh, okay.
So really, I may have the wrong one. It may be just about being a surfer dude.
Yeah.
What she's looking for, The Road to Surf. Dumb. But no, it's Surf from the Knee. So I knew it's one of Reagan's, you know, Reagan loved it. That prick Milton Friedman loved it.
Yeah.
Thatcher loved it, you know. So I knew, you know, right away, you know, it's a Glenn Beck thing. So I had to write her back and say, don't read this book. You don't need to read an Austrian's account of economic disaster in post-war Europe. I mean, that's not important to you. Please don't read
right.
it.
I mean, but that's the whole idea, to just to kind of create a literary salad out of all of these disparate items that he just plucks from obscurity and these weird tomes that people send to him.
Yeah.
You know, that yeah. there's some line somewhere that might be construed as appropriate to this ongoing Glenn Beck narrative. And yeah. and I think ultimately what happens is it's so contrived and it's so spaghetti-like in its twistiness. I mean, it's all played out there on the chalkboards that you get to the point where I think if you're just some rube absorbing your political discourse from Glenn Beck, you're going, wow, this is confusing, but he must know what he's talking about, so
exactly.
God damn it, this has all got to be true.
Exactly.
When in yeah. fact, it's just, I mean, you know, Sarah Palin has word salad, Glenn Beck has political conspiracy theory salad.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because constantly, I mean, I've been watching, you know, and we'll get to this more 2 weeks from Thursday. I mean, yeah. he's always saying that, and I've got this plan, and we'll get to this, you know, a month from next Saturday. It's like, when? What do I have to do? Put this giant calendar down and say, okay, on Tuesday the 5th, he said, and then draw a big, great big arrow to Wednesday the 31st when he wraps up that conspiracy burrito. I can't keep track of it all. And it's all just, it's impossible to debunk factually
yeah.
because, they're, you know, the facts, it's not the facts, it's the interpretation, it's the analysis,
right?
It's not the facts.
It's like debating song lyrics.
Yeah, right.
You know, but I mean, but there are some things that are empirically and objectively true. And there was a great debate. I saw Bill Maher Friday night,
yeah.
but he made his rant at the end was I think one of his best, where yeah. he's talking about there aren't two sides to every argument. There is
right.
a reality. Okay, it's
right.
not like, you know, you can't have this debate about where do children come from. Well, here's one side representing the stork and the other
right.
side representing the vagina.
Right.
You know, there's not
facts,
two sides.
There's, right.
there's empirical reality and that is not debatable.
Right.
Science.
Right. Like evolution verified. And creationism. I mean,
that's right.
creationism is not the fair and balanced, you know, alternative to evolution. Evolution is the cornerstone of all modern biology. That's why I won't argue climate science with fucking wingnuts who don't believe in evolution. I won't do it. If they bring up global warming to me, I say, I'm sorry. First, you have to believe in evolution. You cannot, I will not argue climate science with you when you don't believe in the very basis of modern biology. So
right.
suck it.
So Glenn... So, oh yeah, sorry, you were saying.
Well, I'm just you're right. I mean, and to Mar's point, everyone has everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but not their own facts.
That's right.
I mean, that's how it boiled. That's what it all boiled down to.
And that's
you don't get your own facts.
Yeah, and that's being completely lost in all of this. And I think MSNBC and CNN are equally as guilty as Fox News.
Oh yeah, they all buy into it. you know, one of our very first shows, we were talking about just point and click journalism, where you just you point the microphone at one side, they have their say, the other side has their say, even though it's just empirically wrong, or just absolutely provably false.
Right.
And they go, oh well, what a great discussion we've had. What? We did?
Yeah.
I mean,
even guys like Ed Schultz. I would say, you know what? In fact, Ed Schultz is almost as guilty as anyone. On MSNBC with this. I mean, for God's sake, I mean, every time he has Lanny Davis on debating Tom Tancredo, baby harp seals die. I mean, this is like, it's like the worst. I mean, an angel falls from heaven every time this happens. It is the worst kind of discourse you could possibly have. How about an expert describing what is empirically true?
Yeah.
That is worth, I mean, you have that on, I mean, that's what Rachel Maddow does. That I think is so outstanding about that show, as opposed to Ed Schultz, who feels like, okay, well, here's an immigration debate. Let's bring on Tom Tancredo, who's completely wrong about everything.
Yeah, and just a raving lunatic douchebag racist.
So here, I mean, Glenn Beck, and this is, again, this is empirical fact. There's no debating this. Glenn Beck on his show, and I think we talked about this last week. I forget it, when it specifically happened, but on his show, he described how a bunch of his listeners, this is his radio show, a bunch of his listeners sent him in a stack of books. I mean, he's getting all these classic books from the early 19th century, History of America from, you know, as written in 1849, something like that. And one of the books he received was The Red Network by Elizabeth Dilling. And so he's praising this book. He's talking about, well, this what she describes here is absolutely true. And in fact, he goes on to compliment Joe McCarthy as he's describing this book. Well, Joe McCarthy was right, just his tactics were wrong. And, you know, Elizabeth Dilling was talking about the things Joe McCarthy talked about, but years before.
Yeah.
Right. This is, you know, this is for 1934. This is a pre-war.
Yeah.
Okay, Glenn Beck says, this is a book, and I'm getting a ton of these from people who are doing what we're doing now. So he is now associating himself with authors like Elizabeth Dilling. Elizabeth Dilling is doing it then, 1934. Glenn Beck is doing it now. Mm-hmm. We now are documenting who all of these people are, and he's meaning communists. Well, there were Americans in the first 50 years of this nation that took this seriously, and they documented it. Well, it turns out that Dilling is not quite the hero that Glenn Beck makes her out to be.
No, no.
She's a white supremacist. She
was a nutbag.
She called President Eisenhower Ike the Kike.
She labeled
President Kennedy's New Frontier program the Jew Frontier.
Oh, pow! She's clever.
When World War II began in 1939, Dilling was part of a national network of anti-Semitics. This is from Media Matters. Anti-Semitics, anti-communists, and Nazi sympathizers, such as Father Charles Coughlin, Reverend Gerald L.K. Smith, Reverend Gerald Winrod, William Dudley Pelley. Material generated by Nazi organizations in Germany to inspire race, hated and exploit dissatisfaction in the United States, found its way into Dilling's publications. She spoke at rallies hosted by the leading U.S. Nazi organization, the German-American Bund.
Bund.
Yeah, thank you, Augustus. And had traveled to Germany, pronouncing the country as flourishing under Hitler. Dilling called for appeasing Germany. She blamed the war on Jews and communists and accused the Roosevelt administration of being controlled by Jewish communists. After Pearl Harbor, Dilling resisted wartime rationing and denounced the Allies.
And she thought Eleanor Roosevelt was a commie and also Gandhi. She's smart.
And she's, you know,
she
and
likes
Glenn
to wear funny hats.
Right.
She did.
And Glenn Beck is doing what, I mean, he said it. He's doing now what Elizabeth Dilling did in the 1930s, 40s, 50s.
Own it, Glenn.
50s. Right.
Own it. The Glenn Beck Research Department, everybody. Worse than the Bob and Elvis show's syphilitic rhesus monkey. Mr. Syllabus.
Guess who else is quoting Elizabeth Dilling's work? David Duke.
Oh, he's company you want to keep.
Stormfront door.
Whatever happened to him? That was fun. I love the. I missed the good old days when the Klan could actually run a candidate for office.
That's right.
You know? I mean, we still have Bird. He's still that. Everyone loves to point to old Bird, yeah. the ex Klan guy. But
right.
I just miss the days when the Klan was that politically legitimate. It's like Sinn Fein, you know. We've got the IRA, but then Sinn Fein can be in public office. We got the KKK. They like to hang people and burn crosses, but we also like them to be politicians.
Yeah,
those are the good old days.
Well,
like,
I mean,
should everybody have a voice?
I mean, if Glenn Beck has anything to do with it, and the Tea Party. I mean,
well, speaking of that, let's talk about these primaries, because we've got this Sharon Angle business. I've seen this coming for a long time because of my local Wingnut. You know, she writes me these long, 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 long emails and talks about how she wants to get involved. She wants to run for office. And I'm like, oh, God, help me. And I think that's what's happening with the Sharon Angle business.
Right.
That it's just this outpouring of well-meaning, but really almost marginally retarded people that are being swept up in this movement. And we were already starting to see the sort of Sarah Palin media blackout around Sharon Angle, where she won't, you know, she'll give a speech, but the press has no access to her after that.
Right.
Because you can't press her on issues because she has her head in her ass. But it's just, this is the terrifying nature, I think, of what this Tea Party movement is doing. It's creating, and I tweeted about this the other day, because Meg Whitman got up there, who I would talk about a punch me face. I'm sorry. I am not a misogynist. I've never in my life lifted a finger against a woman. I am terrified of women. And
no,
you
pretend to
but,
hump
oh
them.
Oh my God.
No, that's okay.
Meg Whitman has a punch me face. And
right.
She got up there and said, you know, got a message to those career politicians. And everybody's like, yay. And I can only think about that scene in The Remains of the Day where Christopher Reeve is at the table. He's one of the guests of honor at this British FOPs conference where they're all going to sit around and jerk Germany off to, you know, it's basically a conference of appeasers. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie. It's one of my favorite movies.
Oh, yeah,
of
yeah.
all time.
Of course.
So there's this British FOP who is one of the appeasers, and they're having this conference to decide what should be done about Germany pre-World War II, when Germany's arming and becoming a really serious threat, and basically only Winston Churchill in the entire world knows that this is a problem, while all these dandies in their tuxedos are kissing Germany's ass and saying how what a tragedy the Paris the Versailles Treaty was, which it was, blah blah blah. But Christopher Reeve gets up and they're all having toasts and kissing each other's ass. Christopher Reeve is the American envoy. Gets up and says, "I'd like to have a toast to the professionals," because he basically scolds them all for being amateur politicians, for being, you know, for not understanding rail politic or you know, the politics of reality.
Yeah.
And scolds them all, and they all kind of go, and then later it's all, you know, oh, it's all fine and dandy. But that's exactly what we have now: is this disdain for real politicians. What's the alternative to career politicians? Hobby politicians?
Yeah.
People, you know, armchair politicians. Weekend warrior politicians. I don't get this. What is the backlash against career? Because it's so complicated. The rules of governance and Congress and everything. You want career people in there. You just want them to do a better job, right? I mean, why are we making fun of career politicians?
Because,
I don't get that.
Yeah, you know, it's all part of the elevation of the doofery.
Yes.
As far as I'm concerned.
And Sarah Palin is the queen of that.
That's right.
She's just like us. She's just folks. And Bush was that. I mean, he's the guy. And that's what we got.
Yeah.
This pinhead that had no political bone in his body. I mean, just got put, you know, he had people that did, you know, Rove and whatnot. But these amateur politicians that just don't take it seriously.
That's right. Because, see, career politicians have to go on Meet the Press. And
yes.
Career politicians actually have to answer questions from the media.
Yeah.
God
and they have
forbid.
To have policies.
And
they can't just be against things.
That's
they have
right.
to be for stuff.
And so with Angle, and I think Rand Paul is only going to attend to friendly press. And
yes.
Of course, Sarah Palin being the ringleader of all of it, being
the
yeah, I mean, this year, you know, sort of blazing the trail of, well, F you, media, I don't have to answer your ridiculous questions about the truth.
Yeah. I mean, she did that right in the VP debate. She said, I may not answer the questions you asked me. And that was fine with everyone.
Yeah.
Everyone was just like, oh, isn't she darling?
Yeah.
I'm like, what? What do you mean you're not going to answer the questions you're asked? Oh, my God.
Yeah. So she doesn't have to be held.
They live in a bizarro world.
Yeah. I mean, they don't have to be held accountable. They don't have to study. They don't have to learn. They don't have to research. They don't have to be briefed. All they need to do is, much like George W. Bush before, and we've all heard the stories about how he was kind of a train wreck until Karl Rove forced him to memorize lines and to just simply repeat those lines.
Yeah.
And even then, he still couldn't quite master the whole thing. But, I mean, that's what he did, and that's how he was able to make his way all the way up to being a two-term president of the United States. And so that, I mean, if you want to talk about a trailblazer, I mean, there you go. I mean, George W. Bush, I mean, they, and God bless us, everyone. Americans will continue to eat it up.
Yes. Because that's, I mean, because that personality suits their view of politics. It's like, well, it's all simple. It's, you know, just cut that. It's just less spending. It just cut the budget. Oh, okay. What exactly?
Yeah.
The $200 a month you get from Medicare for your prescription. What you know, your the public education, what do we cut? Where? The military? Yeah. Oh, God forbid.
Right.
You know, one half, you know, there's no policy. There's no, they just want, oh, well, it's simple. Just cut the budget. Just reduce the deficit. Cut taxes. Cut the budget.
Right. And an Angle, it turns out, is a sort of associated with these Oath Keepers.
She's batshit crazy.
Yeah.
She is batshit crazy. I mean, she is beyond crazy. The New York Times front page right now did this morning have a picture of her. It's just there's enough crazy in those eyes for a generation of crazy.
Yeah.
She's nuts.
That's fine
with people.
Yeah. Of course it is. Because she's plain spoken.
Yes.
And she's with this sort of
grassroots,
loud noises,
wonderfulness.
Right.
Hey, the Dow's up 200 points. Woohoo.
Nice. Hey, you look, it might be because of the jobs.
Yeah, there was a pretty good, unemployment report out this morning?
Yeah, they, let me see, jobs. Unemployment benefits dropped by 225,000.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
No, not too bad.
I was really starting to, boy, I don't know if you saw the tweet, but earlier, the late last week, late on a Thursday, late, I mean, took out with the trash. We get a company-wide email from our business unit's VP saying, mandatory business unit call. Everyone must attend. And it's one of those emails with a little red exclamation point next to it. So, you know, they're serious.
Yeah.
Microsoft Outlook tells me that they're serious because there's an exclamation point. So it says mandatory meeting. And in the meeting invite, it says all employees must provide their corporate ID, which is, you know, this 5-digit number letter that is your corporate ID. That has never in the history, I've been with this company 8 years now, that's never happened where you've had to sign on to a call with your corporate ID. It's like they're, you know, it's like they're numbering you, you know, putting a great big barcode on you. So it came in with the trash late at night. So immediately the scuttlebutt is, oh God, mass, you know, because we got bought. My company got purchased.
Yeah.
And we're in the process of merger. So I was certain that I was headed for the unemployment line because of this. And then it turns out the call was absolutely crap. Nothing. I mean, it was just totally nothing. So I could fly to New York and strangle this guy that did this because it was so completely nothing. And we were just all in a complete panic. Spent my entire weekend panicking that I was, you know, headed for the pink slip. So that was nice. I was really looking forward to my unemployment benefits and taking a nap. Someone asked me what I would do. I guess he was asking, you know, what my business plan, you know, where my resume, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I'm going to take a nap. I get laid off. I'm going to take about a 6-day nap.
Nice.
Just a long fucking nap because I'm tired.
Yeah. I mean, we used to, in radio, we used to say, you know, when you get fired, you go to the beach.
Yeah.
That was just, that was sort of the consolation prize. Well, yeah. I just got fired from my radio gig. I'm going to the beach.
Yeah, because what I'm really looking for is an excuse. Like, I was really hoping the 2008 crash would be, you know, depression level, where it would be okay. I said this before, it would be where it would be socially okay and not my fault that I live in an air conditioning box on Fifth, you know, on the corner of Fifth and Maple. You know, I just want the social excuse, the hey, it's not my fault. They got this depression on, you know, I wanted that right. So that I could live in a refrigerator box, because that's the level of downscaling of, you know, downsizing I want to do, with the life. So, you know, a sudden layoff would be good, actually.
Right.
I think I would just be able to tell all my creditors to suck it with bells on and just completely start over.
That's right.
That would be awesome.
Yeah. There with your, you know, your bottle of Stoli in a paper bag, plain paper bag.
God. And a GE air conditioning box for a home. GE, they bring good things to life. I would just love that. You know, eat my animals. I'd finally have an excuse to rid the farm of the 18 living things. Spit them. I could put them over a spit. Have a lovely barbecue.
Hey, you might not be too far off the mark. I posted a blog last night about what I think is the next big, maybe crisis. I don't know, energy crisis in America. Oh, these nuclear power plants are leaking like sieves.
More?
And, yeah. Again? I think more than 27 different nuclear power plants have leaks in them in the United States. And knowing, I think, the president's track record in terms of promoting something and then something going horribly wrong with that technology, whether it was the clean coal and then suddenly a bunch of mines collapse, or we're going to do more offshore drilling and then suddenly Deepwater Horizon and a variety of other things. Natural gas and all these gas lines are bursting.
I'm starting to buy into the environmentalists behind this thing suddenly. I'm starting to buy into the conspiracy that there's some green terrorist running around giggling in his green, you know, Riddler suit. He's like dressed like the Riddler, and he's going from energy source to energy source, blowing shit up. I'm starting to see the logic in that theory.
So if nuclear power plant, I mean, if these power plants go, if one of these goes up, you're going to be living in that box.
Yeah.
Or you're going to be, you know, sort of rationing gasoline like a cast member of the Road Warrior.
I would love that.
You're going to be strung up by the Lord Humongous in the front of your car.
I would love that. I would love to have to shoot a guy off my comically ridiculous truck because he thinks I've got gas and then it turns out to be sand.
Right.
Oh, spoiler alert. Sorry.
Yeah. See, now I live equidistant between Limerick and Three Mile Island, and I don't particularly savor the idea of potentially one of these power plants.
Is there a nuclear plant in Limerick?
Yeah, oh yeah, Limerick, Pennsylvania. It's about 20 minutes from here. I would say equidistant. Limerick's 20 minutes from my house, and Three Mile Island's about 50 minutes from here.
That's a shitload of nuclear in one place, isn't it?
Oh yes, we love our nuclear.
That sounds like a lot of nuclear.
We love nuclear, but you know,
ours,
by the way,
ours is about 35 miles away, and you could put it in your pocket. It's a little bitty thing. I'm not worried about it. Just the radioactive Godzilla cows. When they come to get me, I'm fine. That's how I want to die. I want Godzilla cow. I want cows suffering from rampant Godzillaism to storm the farm of doom and destroy us all.
Oh, and see, you know, the lesson from today's show is you're much, if you gauge our intelligence by our movie references, man, you've got me whooped. I mean, here I am with, I've got
you're on Oompa Loompa Land, and I'm on, like,
Remains of the Day, right?
Yeah, Remains of the Day.
I'm making references to Inspector Gadget and Willy Wonka, and you're like, oh, yeah, that scene in Remains of the Day with her toasting British politics.
God damn right, that's how I roll. Merchant Ivory all the way, baby. Merchant Ivory.
Hey, thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week. Drive safely. If you fudge with us, or you fudge with the best. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
I gotta go fake a seizure.